Movies You Should See is sponsored by Simply Everything. Visit simplysyndicated.com/everything to hear our entire back catalogue, new episodes before they're available as podcasts, and exclusive shows made just for Simply Everything, including every episode of Movies You Should See and the new series of Make It So. Hello, welcome to Movies You Should See. We've been trying this for some time now, so I hope it's good when it comes out the other side. This time we're reviewing the 1958 film, you were right, Alison, I did have the year wrong, Touch of Evil, directed by Orson Welles, starring Charlton Heston as a Mexican.
We're not doing The Devil's Backbone?
No, that was the other night. I put this on the list just for you, Rick, actually. Just for you, because I know we'd made you watch it before, and we never did a show on it, and that seemed mightily unfair to me, so I wanted to make sure that you got to do a Movies You Should See on it.
I appreciate that.
So it's because of you, or your fault, depending on how you feel about it, that we're back here.
I was just following orders, sir.
Exactly. So it's all good. We're good to go. So let's have a bit of an opening thing. I'm going to go with Alison first this time, because she always goes last.
I've been going last, haven't I? Yeah. It's because I rambled on the other night. I won't ramble on here. This is a masterpiece. Absolute perfection in direction and lighting. And I adore it and look forward to watching it many, many times, because I was kind of blown away by the visuals this first viewing. And I need a little bit more time with the story, I think. And I'm going to look forward to that. It's perfect.
Awesome. Rick, where are you with this, having had plenty of time to digest where you are with it?
It's maybe a bit of a repeat from the network show. I watched this. I hadn't really heard of it before, and to be honest, after I watched it, I had to do some research on just why it's considered a classic. I mean, it's not bad by any stretch, but it doesn't really stand out to me as anything particularly special. Once again, maybe over the course of the next hour or so, y'all will help me figure out why.
Well, okay. 138th best film of all time, according to IMDb. That's where this one's coming out. So, Matt, how are you with it?
I really enjoyed it. Again, I'd never heard of it before. And as I was reading it, or reading about the movie, like the Admiral did, I just realized how many other places I've seen this movie and not realized it.
Yeah.
So it's definitely got an impact on the cinema world at large, but I really, really enjoyed this film.
I know what you mean. I wanted to see it because of the movie Get Shorty.
Really?
In which they go and see this film.
Right,
and you see the end bit. And as it plays out, John Travolta sat in the audience saying it along with the film. And so I always thought I'd like to see that film, the film within a film, because it's a real film.
Right.
And it is Touch of Evil. Mm. And he jokes, come on, let's go see Charlton Heston be a Mexican. You know, so it's pretty good. Who's Scott? That's who's next.
That's who's next.
Hey, Scott.
It is. Hello. Well, for my first statement on the movie, I want to actually turn it over to a special guest that we have. Hello, Richard. I am Miguel Vargas from Mexico. Because I am Mexican.
I can tell that by your mustache.
That's what does it. Mexican men have mustaches. And that's it. That is how we know they are Mexican.
I was literally practicing that at work today.
I bet you were.
Because I wanted to have that ready for tonight.
It was very good. Well done, indeed.
Well done.
Mike Vargas. Mike.
Miguel Vargas. So, yeah. I was definitely gladdened to read the bit of trivia on IMDb saying that Charlton Heston considers his not doing a Latino accent in this film one of the biggest mistakes of his acting career.
It really was. It really was, because to be fair, if you'd not read that he was playing a Mexican, you would have maybe thought he was American.
Yeah, that 1950s American federal agent spends a lot of time at the tanner.
He does, yeah. He's got a lot of makeup on, and it's quite funny.
I can't imagine Charlton Heston doing a Latino accent and it not being hilarious.
He should have tried. He should have at least tried.
I'm thinking Manuel Fawlty Towers is where it's coming out.
It sounded like a couple of times he tried, but he slipped right back into that Charlton Heston accent.
You know what it reminded me of? Have any of y'all ever seen The Conqueror?
No.
It's John Wayne playing Genghis Khan.
Oh, I've heard about it. Yes. I've heard about it. Oh, man.
It is one of the worst movies ever made, especially because of the fact that you've got John Wayne with the Asian eye makeup, and his entire horde are all Mexican. It's just the most brilliantly wrong movie ever.
Wasn't that Howard Hughes that put that movie together?
I don't know, but it's worth watching because it's just such a train wreck of a film.
This happens at various points. It's a bit like Davy Crockett, the Disney films where he fights the Indians, and they're as Indian looking as I am. Quite literally, it's just a bunch of white guys painted brown. Not a Native American amongst them. They've never even met one.
The old Charlie Chan films.
Yeah. Or Breakfast at Tiffany's, which we're all still supposed to think is a wonder of cinema, terrible. And it's just really upsetting. And damn, is that woman high maintenance. You would not want to go out with that woman.
No.
Okay,
making me thirsty, that is.
Is someone doing a bong? No. Is that what this is? Because that was doing a bong or blowing bubbles in milkshake. It was one or the other.
I would never do that sort of thing. I am a federal agent.
Okay, no, that was, Senor Vargas, I believe you.
I apologize. It was me pouring more coffee.
Oh, right. Okay.
We forget super spy microphones here in our new recording setup. Yeah.
I should tell everyone this will be like the third week for you, second or third week for you, but we're trying out a new recording system that isn't Skype this evening. And it's not without its hiccups, to be honest with you.
If we get hiccups, it's probably going to sound like the world's ending.
Yeah, but it's made everybody's microphone really loud and sensitive. So
yeah, I'll actually tell the truth. That sound that you heard, that was the neighbor pouring coffee.
There you go. Yeah. And the nearest neighbor is 7 miles. And they're out.
One thing that may have contributed to my, I don't want to say lack of appreciation of this film, but just my bafflement at why it's such a classic, is you all have referenced several films that reference this film that I've never seen. And it may just be because I'm such a Philistine when it comes to non-science fiction movies.
Yeah. Are you familiar with noir films, other noir films? Have you seen The Third Man?
No.
Have you seen Citizen Kane?
No.
See, I think it might be quite difficult to have no reference points. You know, there's no Big Sleep there. There's no Double Indemnity. You've got none of those films in your catalogue of memories to sort of juxtapose it with.
Yeah.
But I think, for me, I would just advise you maybe to just watch it just the visuals. Forget the story.
One of the first things in my notes is beautiful use of shadows and anyway, what did I can't read what I wrote here. I can't read it. It's gorgeous something.
Yeah. It's truly uses black and white to the most beautiful effect in this film.
Well, that whole opening is one take, isn't it?
As the
car is driving.
It's like 3.5 minutes.
Yeah.
It took them ages. In fact, they nearly got to daylight. You can just see daylight coming up at the end of that shot because it really was their last chance to do it and get it right. So they were racing against the sun, basically. And there were a lot of reasons for that. He wanted to film at night to basically discourage studio people coming down and poking their nose in. Because he didn't really want to do it anyway. This is the thing. It was quite, you know, it's late on his career. He's getting a little bit curmudgeonly, maybe.
Who's this, Wells?
Yeah. Right. And he's not really up for working on this, but he's under contract, so he's got to do it. And he's part of the American Hollywood system where his films are going to be subject to other people's changes and that kind of thing. And by this point in his career, he's not happy with that at all. And this is kind of his swan song sort of thing. It did really well elsewhere, but in America, no.
Hmm. Now, I was very impressed with his performance and his willingness to look terrible.
Oh, yeah. He's a grimy, grimy character, is Quinlan. He's a dirty copper who's embittered against something, and it takes us quite a long while to figure out what embittered him and what made him into this fat, dirty, greasy, sleazy slob that we see in front of us, who is prepared to bend the law so that it fits his view of what's occurred. And we don't get to figure that out for a while. But he does it so well. He declines through the film. He gets greasier and more drunk and more slovenly as time goes on. And he does it so well. He's not actually that fat either. He's got lots of padding on and wanted to be shot from underneath, so he looked even bigger and more slobbish.
And they did that well because I was convinced that was all natural.
Yeah. It looked good. I mean, it was just like positioning of his neck, really, that showed all of the flesh at the front of his neck that you could see, and then the rest of it was padding and big clothes.
It was, I think, only at the very end, the very last scene where his character shows up, that I could actually tell that they had applied a lot of makeup and some prosthetics to his face. But before that, it looked pretty natural. I found him to be a combination of three people. It was apparently Jackie Gleason from Smokey and the Bandit, crossed with John Goodman, crossed with the actor who played Porkins in Star Wars Episode 4, but not from Star Wars, but from his role in Tim Burton's Batman.
That's right. He was the dirty cop, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was Eckhart, the big fat trench coat wearing cop who always has a cigar.
He's like a really slovenly Columbo after his wife's finally left him. But more bitter, because she didn't leave him, she was murdered. Right.
Do you think Columbo's wife eventually left him?
No.
I don't think
she eventually got her own show. Well, wait, no, she did eventually leave him and captained the Starship Voyager.
Yes.
Fair enough. Right then.
You know, tonight is kind of, is it okay to talk about what night this really is?
It's not a secret.
It's sort of serendipitous because tonight is also the anniversary of Orson Welles' War of the Worlds broadcast.
Of course.
Right.
Yes.
Which was
for what that's
huge. No, it was.
Let's pretend
it was
we planned
huge. That. Have you imagined what it's been like to hear that?
Well, apparently, I haven't read any of the stories that are going around yet, but apparently the rumors of the panic caused by it have been greatly exaggerated.
Have they really?
Yeah. Which, if you've ever heard the broadcast. I used to have a tape of it. And I used to,
we had it on vinyl.
Yeah,
set of Jeff Wayne's War of the Worlds. That's what we had.
That's a
with all the orchestration. That's what we had. We didn't have the Orson Welles one.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, but the Orson Welles broadcast at the very beginning sounds like a news report, but once you get into the actual story, it's pretty obvious it's a radio play.
Yeah.
So that always kind of didn't jibe with it having caused a panic.
Yeah.
And now that I'm seeing all these stories saying, well, it really didn't. This was just a publicity stunt.
Yeah.
or not, no, it wasn't. I think they said it was a story drummed up by Wells's competition to try to say that they were like irresponsible or something.
Yeah, it was no Ghostwatch.
Yeah, exactly. War of the Worlds didn't cause any post-traumatic stress disorder.
That's it. Ghostwatch did cause that in me and others, apparently. But Orson Welles has such a... He has the oddest career of anyone.
Who, really. Orson Welles?
Orson Welles. When you look at what he was in, what he made, the span of time over which he made it, I mean, with Citizen Kane, he basically invented modern cinema techniques. Until that, cameras were locked off.
Mm.
Films were pretty much film of a play.
On a stage.
On a stage. Yeah. And he invented moving the camera.
Yeah.
And little things like that.
Not just on the side dolly.
He's arguably one of the most important people in all of cinema. And instrumental in the next 70 years of film. Which, for any artist working in any category of art, is one hell of an achievement, wouldn't you say?
Mm. Very much.
To you know, if he was an artist who started a style, that would be all he'd be remembered for. Mm. But he had. I agree.
The hound of the Baskervilles.
Did you cry havoc?
No, but my dog did.
Shakespeare references.
Shakespeare, I thought that was General... his name?
I was going to say, that's a Star Trek reference. That's not Shakespeare.
Either way works. Makes me glad he's my co-host.
Yes. It's why we love him and things like that. But his career included many, many ups and downs, not quite befitting the inventor of modern cinema. He was in two Magnum PIs, for fuck's sake. Mm. He was the voice of Unicron in Transformers the movie.
He also narrated That's Ricky right. Ticky Tavy.
He did an advert for peas.
Do you know who Orson Welles is to me and to most Americans of my generation?
The man who gave Kermit the Frog his contract.
No.
Oh.
Is he the movie announcer?
No.
Trailer
guy. He was back when you could advertise alcohol.
Probably the best lager in the world.
We will sell no wine before it's time. every person my age will remember that jingle. And that's why it didn't even occur to me that Welles was padded in this movie, because I remember him as, you know, 800 pounds of wine hawking bearded Pavarotti dude. And it wasn't until, you know, I was much older that I found out that there was a whole lot more to this dude than just doing commercials and being huge.
Mm.
Although I would have loved to have seen Marlon Brando and Orson Welles in a belly bucking contest, now that I think about it.
That would be interesting.
I've derailed this. I apologize.
Well, now we're all stuck trying to picture it in our heads. Thanks very much, Admiral.
The most pretentious sumo wrestler ever. How about that wife? She was kind of an idiot.
A little bit. A little bit.
The wife played by Janet Leigh. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, she needs to stay away from motels.
She needs to stay away from Mexicans with pieces of paper in their hand.
Yeah, that too.
Yeah, because that's basically what leads her into silly trouble here. So this was Orson Welles' idea as well, to cast Charlton Heston and have him Mexican, because he was supposed to be an American, but he said, no, let's make him Mexican, and let's make Janet Leigh American. So, because it was supposed to be the other way around.
Yeah, Charlton Heston had already been cast, actually. Mm-hmm. And the reason that Orson Welles went from being an actor in the film to also directing is because Charlton Heston had been mistakenly informed that Orson Welles was directing.
Yeah, so he didn't want to let him down.
Right, in order to keep Heston happy, they said, hey, Orson, how about you direct this also? And he's like, okay. So he did it. And one of the first things he did was to take one of the earlier drafts and say, we're going to change everything. And they made Vargas Mexican instead of white, and they made his wife white instead of Mexican. Yeah. Why? Who knows?
Well, I just think it's a nice juxtaposition, you know, because we're used to seeing that old Western kind of movie where the American guy meets the Mexican woman, and they go off and live in their own Puebla somewhere away from everybody's trouble, you know. So it was like flipping that on its head. I've seen John Ford do it the other way. I'm going to do it this way.
It causes it really flips things around when you do it that way, because it makes it. It changes things, because everything takes place in Mexico, and so that changes it to being his homeland instead of hers, and the person doing all the investigating is actually a foreigner.
Yeah.
And that's quite a significant change in the way things would work, and that sort of thing.
There's questions of jurisdiction and things like that that are involved in. Well, we should say, the beginning tracking shot is we're following a bomb in a car with what looks like an older guy and a beautiful young blonde woman in the passenger seat. And we follow the car and we see Vargas and his new bride, Janet Leigh, there by the car when it finally explodes. We've seen somebody attach a device to the back. And he's supposed to be going to America. He's on his honeymoon, but no, the car's blown up right next to him. He's got to figure out what's happened, which is like, I'm sorry, darling, I'll be back soon. Like, well, put the honeymoon on ice. We fucking won't. We're going now.
Yeah, right.
He does that all throughout the movie. We're about to leave now. Oh, a car's exploded. Wait here, honey. And he runs off to take care of that. And then after that's finished, oh, now there's something else I have to take care of. You stay in this hotel by yourself. I'm going to go handle this for a day and a half.
That's one of my complaints. As much as I love the movie, it's filled with idiots. Because there's that one scene where Quinlan basically tells Vargas, your wife's in trouble. And Vargas is like, yes, I will just go look up your records now. Just like, guy, he just basically waved a flag and said, your wife is in trouble.
You're supposed to skip now. You're supposed to skip now.
I think Quinlan might have even winked at him at that point when he said it. Your wife is in trouble. Wink. Hint, hint. Nudge him with his elbow. And he's like, I'll attend to that later.
And then just spends another half a day. Yeah. It's a bit of a shame, that, really. But
if you're busy, you're busy, you know. Crack on.
So what we've got is an investigation here into who's driving the car and who's next to him. And we've got this guy who's wealthy. And he's the one who the hit is with. The girl in the passenger seat is clearly just a bit of a stripper that he's taking home with him. Because he likes that kind of thing.
Well, why not?
And we figure out through some brilliant detective work that his daughter is in love with a Mexican. So we've got that same situation of the American girl and the Mexican man that she's in love with, and it can't possibly happen, or she's going to disinherit, and therefore this young Mexican has the motive to kill the old guy. And it's nice, it's neat, isn't it? So Quinlan wants to make sure that it's nice and neat. And that's basically where we go. We start seeing this odious man planting evidence and making suggestions that completely back up his theories, because his wife was murdered by a strangler who got away.
Right.
And he won't let murderers get away. Now, in a perfect world, that means that he solves every crime perfectly, but in his world, it is embittered and lonely and decreasing carefulness in his life. In his world, it means breaking the law himself and making facts fit.
Right. And that right there is a better and more understandable rundown of the plot than you get from watching the actual movie.
This is the thing. It is very convoluted, and some scenes are really difficult. And I think Orson Welles has done a lot of it on purpose. Some of the scenes, he's got so many people cramped into such a claustrophobic shot that you really feel like these rooms are tiny. Everyone's on top of each other. The dialogue's on top of each other, and some of it's in Spanish. and we never hear Charlton Heston say anything in Spanish, really. He kind of half translates, and that in itself is quite difficult. And then there's this gang that's also in town who clearly own everything. Are they standees? No, they can't be standees. Grandees.
Which I'm pretty sure was... I want to know how they spelled that, because if that's how they pronounce grande,
I think it's grandee,
just even funnier.
I think it's supposed to be grandee with an E, with an I on the end.
Yeah.
But yeah, Uncle Joe Grandy, Akim Tamirov plays him.
It wasn't even Mexican.
It doesn't look like it, no.
They reminded me of like the biker gangs from the Beach Blanket Bingo movies. I don't know if y'all saw those over there in England. It was the Frankie Avalon, Annette Funicello kind of, I don't know, precursors to the Herbie movies.
Okay.
I'm familiar with them. I've never seen one as such, but yeah.
Well, you know, I kept waiting for something really menacing to happen to the wife. I don't remember her name, I'm afraid.
Susan.
And then I kept remembering that this movie was from 1958. So the kind of, you know, really horrible stuff that would have happened if that movie was made today just wasn't going to happen.
Well, there's kind of hints that some horrible stuff happens, but then it's kind of like, and we won't talk about that. And she's fine now. So basically, while he's off busy figuring out what's going on with this here bomb and getting increasingly concerned and obsessed with Quinlan, she's been handed a note that sort of makes us know that there's some kind of dark element in this town as well. And there's strange men with cigarettes looking at her with their mustaches, passing her notes that are kind of suggesting that there's a danger to her.
I'm muted.
Say that again, sorry.
Oh, that was Mumble saying right. That Scott is now unmuted.
Okay.
You can turn that off.
Yeah, I just did. Oh, okay. I didn't realize it was doing it. We'll just pretend all that never happened. I'm not actually here.
The most sinister character in this whole film for me was the janitor dude at the hotel.
Yeah.
Or at the motel, sorry.
Oh, you mean Buster Bluth from Arrested Development?
Yeah.
That guy just freaked me the fuck out.
He was odd, wasn't he? He was a very bizarre creature.
And yet he was the most harmless of the bunch, but he was just so creepy.
He was kind of a little bit sexually driven, wasn't he? But at the same time, having absolutely no social skills.
Yeah. Right.
And all kinds of stuff is happening around him that he's not engaging in because maybe it's a bit scary out there. Because he does know that some people have come and are having a loud party. She's in this motel. And he's been told it's owned by the gang boss.
And if they expect him to clean that up, then they have another thing coming.
Yeah.
I've got two things I wrote in my notes about that motel. My first thing was, where's Torgo?
And how can I never go there?
If anybody's ever seen Manos, The Hands of Fate.
No, not yet.
Oh, you've got, well, no, you don't have to see Manos. You have to watch the MST3K treatment of Manos. Manos is quite deservedly called the worst movie ever made. It is an absolutely abysmal horror film from the early 70s and is one of the Mystery Science Theater 3000's most popular episodes. And, we'll just leave it there. And then later on I have, oh no, not Reefer.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that was the terrible things they did to her.
Yeah.
And heroin. Because, you know, there is some dark stuff going on that's all apparently being ordered by Quinlan. You know, she's being terrorized because he's making it happen. And, there's the cumulative scene in a scene called The Assault where all of these younger gang members of the Grandy family come along, including some women as well, and all go into her room and sort of surround her on the bed as she's terrified and pick her up, and the door closes, and it's kind of a suggestion that there's a gang rape going on in there as well. It's a very physical attack where she's completely, you know, spread apart by these people as the door closes, and later we see the aftermath. They've left reefer butts around the place, and they've injected her with some heroin. I mean, you know.
No, it was
sodium pentothal.
Pentothal. It's a good job, because she would have died with heroin. It's as simple as that. She wouldn't have come back that night. She, you know, she certainly wouldn't have been in bed sweating.
So their assault amounted to, okay, we're going to give her some quote-unquote truth serum, and then we're going to blow marijuana smoke on her while she's surrounded by the rejected cast of the Latino revival of Grease.
Yeah.
Nothing.
Exactly. That's exactly what it was like. But, you know, it suggested something far darker than we were shown. And then it was like, oh, she's okay now. There's no post-trauma after that.
Yeah, that was what the problem with it was, is you didn't see what happened, and she didn't seem particularly bothered by it afterwards.
No.
So.
No. You know, she wasn't given a forgetting drug. She was given right. a truth drug. That's going to
so,
make...
So either she really liked it, or...
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I didn't realize that sodium pentothal would put you down that much, but I'm pretty sure that having Mexicans blow marijuana smoke on you is not going to make you go into that state. I'm pretty sure.
No.
No,
but these are tiny flaws for me. These are tiny flaws.
Well, it seemed that her character was only able to be bothered by one thing, and that's loud music and people partying on the other side of the wall. That's really the only thing that upset her.
Yeah.
Imagine how they would play that character if they did a 55-year anniversary remake and they made that movie today.
Oh, he'd
everything,
die. He'd
everything die. That Vargas does would send her right over the edge.
Yeah, right. I mean, they'd have gotten divorced at the point where he said, we're not having a honeymoon. She went, well, fuck it then. Annulled. See ya. Ta-ta. End of film. You know.
Now, there was one thing that required me doing the research afterwards that I kind of wish I had known going into it. Excuse me. The gypsy fortune teller confused me as to, one, why she was there, and two, why she played such a major role in it. And then I found out that she was Marlena Dietrich.
You didn't know it was her.
I did not know that was her. So the fact that, you know, this tiny little part suddenly became so important almost out of the blue. And then later on, I found out this was the big cameo.
It was huge. Yeah. And she'd agreed to do it for virtually no money, but she's got a substantial part in it. You know, Zsa Zsa Gabor's in it as well. Blink and you miss her.
Oh, yeah. She was. I saw her.
Yeah. She's like, I didn't know her. She hasn't been working here very long. And that was it. Oh, okay, Zsa Zsa, nice seeing you. See you, nice.
And she's passing off through the studio when they threw her on camera.
Kind of, yeah. She's like having a sarnie in the canteen or something.
I have to say, though, I had no idea that the Gabors were that hot when they were young.
Oh, yeah. There's a reason why she clocked all those husbands. You know, we only really remember looking at her in the 80s when it's like, oh, really?
Yeah, she was on every game show in history.
She was everywhere in the 80s. That's the only time I knew what she looked like. So for me, like watching the old black and white, I was like, oh, that was her. And it's like Barbara Stanwyck was she in Dallas or Dynasty? One of the two. And she was she was Miss Ellie, wasn't she? No.
No, she was. Oh, she was head of the Big Valley was the show she was on. She was the head of the. It was a competing show with Bonanza.
Right.
She was the matriarch. Yeah.
But you know, then you go back and see her in Double Indemnity or The Lady Eve, and you're like, wow, she was stunning.
Well, Angela Lansbury. Look at her in The Court Jester. She was stunning, gorgeous.
Mm.
But all we think of her as is, you know, the Murder, She Wrote or Bed Knobs and Broomsticks. When she
was she
know,
not
in
fit
50s.
In Murder, She Wrote?
Yeah, no idea.
Really? Okay.
You know they're remaking that series.
I did hear that the other day. Actually. What? Yeah.
Yep, new Murder, She Wrote, coming soon.
No.
I'm assuming not with Angela Lansbury.
Not with Angela Lansbury. I can't remember the name of the actress, but they are they're going to redo Murder, She Wrote with a black actress because things went so well when they tried to remake Raymond Burr's Ironside with Blair Underwood in the wheelchair, and after four episodes, it canceled it. So we're on a roll.
Did that make it four episodes? I saw it pop up on a popular website where people might acquire television shows, and did have a little chuckle to myself. But wow, mind you, Murder, She Wrote. Maybe now people would just, when she's investigating a murder, just turn to her and go, "Why are you here? You write books. That doesn't mean you get to investigate actual murders with the police. You are not in the police."
Well, isn't that the basic concept of Castle?
Castle, yeah.
Yep, exactly.
I don't know. I've not seen that yet.
Well, I haven't either, but it's Nathan Fillion's show, current show, and it's quite the hit.
Yeah, sorry, go ahead, Rick.
No, if you've seen it, go ahead. You probably know more about it than I do.
No, I've seen the first half of the first season of Castle, but I very much got a Murder, She Wrote vibe to it. Or from it when I was watching it. So when I heard they were remaking Murder, She Wrote, I said, oh, someone's been noticing how well Castle is doing in the ratings. They're going to try and take that core concept, attach it to a recognized name, and see if that helps them take off.
Yeah, but now they're going to run the risk of the younger generation go, oh, they're just ripping off Castle. Why are we going to watch this?
People are already saying that. The one podcast that I've listened to that discusses it already brought that up.
Okay.
Well, if I may put forth a slight observation that if this show remains true to form, there will be no younger generation watching it, so it's not really an issue.
This is true.
Yeah, I have to admit, the only place that I ever saw Murder, She Wrote on the television was at my grandparents' house.
I watched a Murder, She Wrote not long ago.
No. You're not my grandfather, so no, you didn't.
I did. There was a crossover episode with Magnum P.I. I'm not making it up. There was a crossover episode.
Oh, no. There were a lot of crossovers to Murder, She Wrote.
Murder, She Wrote and Magnum P.I., where she goes and investigates a murder.
Did she meet Mr. Magnum?
With Tom Selleck. Yeah.
So we got that crossover, but we didn't get the Quantum Leap Magnum P.I. crossover?
No, we didn't.
That's a shame.
Shame.
The Quantum Leap Murder, She Wrote crossover would have been amazing as well. He could have leaped into Angela Lansbury.
Oh, no.
As some of us may have fantasized about. From time to time. Oh, that made it gross, didn't it? I'm sorry. Leapt into Angela Lansbury last night. That. Yeah.
I think this calls for another episode of Remote Patrol where we go back and revisit Quantum Leap for one more episode.
That's terrifying.
Last episode.
All right, somebody refresh my memory here. I wrote, one of the last things I wrote as I was watching it was obtuse over theatrical ending, but I remember them running around with radios and stuff.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, it looks good, but it's silly. It's all very silly because we've got to the point now where Vargas knows that Quinlan has got his wife, done horrible things, planted evidence to frame the kid, whether it's true or not, he still planted evidence, and continues to do wily things, and has killed someone else, and left evidence that it's there. So he's like, right, I've got all this now, and he eventually even convinces his sycophantic sidekick, Quinlan's sycophantic sidekick, what's his name?
Menzies,
yeah, Joseph Calleja. He's always been around him and supported him and all this kind of stuff, but slowly Vargas has convinced him to look beyond what Quinlan's telling him and see if there's anything else there. And he's like, okay, yeah, he did this. I'm going to help you. So they rig up a radio with a microphone and a recorder. And Quinlan's got it attached to him.
Menzies.
Menzies has got it attached to him while Vargas follows close by.
Oh, that's right. He had like very short range.
The world's shortest range radio.
Terribly had to keep moving.
With no exaggeration, an honest to God reel to reel in the box.
Yep.
But I love that.
It was always, I mean, it looks fantastic. From a cinematic point of view, it's great that we can see Vargas underneath in the shadows, especially around the bridge. And then these two on a kind of lit bridge, we can see them. It looks spectacular, but it's stupid because you wouldn't have set up that conversation to go over the bridge, forcing you to go through water and over obstacles and all this kind of stuff just to get it. And you wouldn't have had the volume turned up so that they can hear bouncing off the little tunnel walls. I mean,
don't they have headphones in the 50s?
They've got reel-to-reel microphones and recorders, then surely they've got some kind of headphone technique. I'm sure they use them in the war, you know.
He didn't even need headphones. Consider how close he was. He had to stay so close to get the signal. He can hear them with his ears.
Every word. And so can we, because there's a microphone on set. So we're all good. There's no reason for that volume to be on. I don't know why that got through. I really don't. But there's also this thing about Quinlan being prescient in some kind of way. He has feelings, you know. He gets the sense. And somehow at the end he does get the sense, and the sense is right. But it's probably just quite clever because he's being asked some very specific questions.
Yeah.
He's getting feelings in his magic legs.
Yeah. No, he can hear some idiot down about 12 feet splashing around with a fucking radio. That's what he can hear.
Oh. No, he didn't even hear the splashing. He just heard his own voice through the speaker. He doesn't hear the guy scrambling through the water who conveniently has had his shirt wide open for the past 10-15 minutes of the movie for no reason whatsoever.
It's Charlton Heston. Let's make him more handsome. We've already given him a tan and a tash. I mean, how much more gorgeous can he get? I know, let's open him to the navel.
When I first saw him with his shirt open down that far, it took me completely out of the scene because all I was thinking to myself was, why is his shirt open like that?
Why?
He was
Have you never seen any other Charlton Heston movies? He's worse than Jim Kirk as far as getting his shirt off.
He kind of is, yeah. It's like, I've paid for this chest, you're seeing it.
He's naked throughout most of Ben-Hur.
Yeah.
At least he didn't end this movie riddled with bullets like he did most of his movies in the 70s.
Yeah. Planet of the Apes, he's got the thing on for most of that. You know.
Planet of the Apes, Soylent Green, Omega Man. Every one of those films ends with him dying with either a spear in his gut or a billion bullets in him, screaming some line at the top of his voice as he gurgles away to die.
Mm. But we get a happy ending here, don't we, really?
Yeah, yeah.
As happy as one can be when one's just witnessed two murders and been through a gang rape and been injected with drugs. Yeah, we're all fine and dandy now. Let's get in the car and go on.
The closing of the movie shows us that Miguel and Susan are really not all that important because they run to each other. He says, it's all right now. I'm going to take you home. And they just vanish.
Yes,
we spend the rest of the movie watching Quinlan's body float out into the water with Vargas's lawyer buddy saying to the fortune teller, something cryptic and goodbye, and she walks away.
Do you know
the important ones.
Yeah. Did you hear what the something cryptic was?
I know I did at the time, but it has already floated away.
The something cryptic was, well, it was that kid anyway. There's enough evidence that's not come from Quinlan to suggest that it definitely was
that, him. That's right, because the suspect eventually confessed to being the one that blew up the car.
He did,
showing us that Quinlan was in fact right, but he's still a dick.
He's still dirty, yes. And you can't play dirty. You've got to do it by the book. And he was so far off the book, it was untrue.
And you know, I think that's... Oh, sorry.
Go on, it's okay.
I think that that is one of the failings of this movie, in my opinion, is that the actual crime really wasn't important. It almost had nothing. I mean, it was the impetus for everything.
Mm.
But at the end of the film, it didn't matter who blew up the car. At the end of the film, all that mattered was that Quinlan was dirty and that he finally got his comeuppance.
It was how far he was prepared to go. I mean, here he was setting up the Vargases to be suspected of murder, of drug use, of all kinds of stuff, when he's the guy who's arranged it all, nicked a gun, murdered someone else, all this kind of stuff. It's all him. The evil touch is his, not the person who blew up the car at the beginning. You're right, that crime is not what this film's about. It's about how far someone like Quinlan will go.
Right.
In his pursuit of being right. And, you know, the way it's shot is just so sleazy and dirty and grimy, just like his character. And the framing of the shots where everybody's crammed in and the camera's low down, you know, like 3 feet, and everybody's huddled together. I suppose it was about how his wife was feeling. 'Cause in the story, she's having more of an experience of Mexico in the daytime than he is. She's the one trapped in his country. He's the one trapped. He's trapped in there. But that last line where he says, "Let's go home," he means America.
But keep in mind, when she was in the motel, she was in America the whole time. That was an American hotel.
Mm. So she's still got her freedom, in a sense, even though she's got none, because she's kind of trapped. But he entraps himself in Mexico because he just can't walk away.
He kind of traps her in the motel. He sends her away, so go stay in that hotel. And without checking the hotel, without staying with her until she gets checked in, without realizing, oh, there's literally no one here in this motel except for the bad guys. But she's okay with it for some reason.
She's fine. Right? I mean, like, she's the kind of woman who gets over things quickly.
And she trusts everybody. She has no suspicion of anyone throughout the entire movie.
Oh, you've handed me a note. I guess that means I'll follow you. What? No, right. Don't do that.
As I'm here in Mexico, where my husband is a federal agent who is actively involved in a case that is running right now against a drug ring. Oh, you're a stranger with a note and you know who I am? Oh, yeah. Well, let's just take a walk. This way?
We'll go into this dark room over here.
Well, you know when the first thing that tipped me off that she was not the sharpest knife in the drawer is when the guy ran up and took a picture of her, and, you know, the guy grabs her and they take the picture. Mm. And she doesn't immediately go to her husband and say, "This just happened."
Yeah.
Instead, she goes, "Okay, I'll go to wherever you're sending me." Maybe if they had done something to establish her character as maybe thinking that she could be as good a detective as her husband and wanting to prove that or something like that, yeah, I might have bought it a little more.
Yeah. It was a shame that they didn't, the script didn't give her more. It did play her up as a stupid woman who was just going to go, "Okay, Dan," and occasionally shout, "Mike."
Also, yeah, with the flashlight from across the alley into the hotel room.
Mm.
So someone in the next building is following her with a flashlight.
And she's not even having a conversation with concierge at this point. Oh my God, you know?
And then when her federal agent husband comes into the room and says, "Why is it dark?" Is it because there's no light bulb? And she doesn't mention, "Because I threw it at the guy that kept on watching me with a flashlight in a very suspicious manner."
Because I know that's exactly what if I see somebody suspicious looking at me, I'm going to start hucking light bulbs.
That's right, yeah. I'd not thought of that one before this film.
After already getting shaken down by the local drug ring.
Mm.
Right.
See, these are flaws. To me, they're little. They're still little. Because there's two women in this film, really. I'm going to completely forget the original victim's daughter, because she just wails a lot at the beginning and then she's gone. We see Zsa Zsa Gabor for 20 seconds, if that. And then
I think maybe more like 10.
Yeah. And then we've got Marlene Dietrich, who's around a fair bit more but says very little. And she basically just does Marlene Dietrich here. She looks utterly stunning, I think. Her eyes are just the best eyes ever. And I can't help falling in love with the image of her as she stood in the doorway smoking the cigarillo thing. Just looking at him like, I don't know what I think of you. I don't like you. I don't love you. I don't hate you. I tolerate you. You're grimy and you belong here. And because she's a fortune teller, but she's also a madam. So he's got a reason to hang around her. You know, she's got his girls and where he can drink and smoke and do whatever he wants. And have his seediness, so that's what she's around for. She's quite pathetic. She doesn't see a future for him. She just thinks he's sad, really. I think that's her expression, that she's just a bit sad for him.
I think that might have been my favorite line in the movie. When he asks her to tell his future and she says, you have no future, it's all used up. I don't know why, but that
would be a lot of a Tennessee Williams play.
Yeah.
Now that I think about it.
Now you mention it, yeah.
Tennessee writes better, though. I've got to say.
Well, yeah.
He handles all of his characters much more even-handedly than the writers of this script.
Well, yeah, Williams will depress the shit out of you and have you thanking him for it. I've done far too many Tennessee Williams shows. Is this... Was this something like the seediness and lowness, I guess would be the right word, of these characters? Is this something that was not really seen on the screens in 1958? Was this like a cutting edge film?
It's the way it's shot. It's entirely in the way it's shot. And I think if this film would have been put in somebody else's hands, it would have been completely different. Instead, it turns into a photographic masterpiece. Because it might some of it is a little reaction against the studio by working at night, but most of it's about choosing darkness and light and how to shoot actors, how to direct, and this to me is the greatest example of framing in a film. There, I said it.
Okay.
It's huge. There were so many moments when I was watching it where I just felt like all the air had come out of me, like, oh, that's a shot. Oh, my God. Oh, look at that. You know, and I was just like that all the way through. And then I was more appreciating the visuals than I was following the contrived plot at some points. I was just watching it, especially in the darkened rooms where you've got everyone shouting and in different languages.
Right.
Just spectacular shots.
Yeah, I watched this on my laptop, and I'm wondering if I should get a copy of the DVD someday and throw it up on my bigger TV to really get some of those visuals. But it was, yeah, I was getting lost in the visuals a lot too, and kind of forgiving some of the obvious holes in the plot and, you know, the idiots everywhere. Like, why can't you see who's doing this?
That's where I'm at with it. I don't care about all of those flaws. And I, you know, right. I've been happy to sit and rip along with you. I'm okay with them, but they're inconsequential to my overall reaction to this film.
I mean, I've always said I'm much more of a visual guy. Like, story for me always takes second chair.
Yeah.
As long as the visuals entertain me and keep me interested, the story can be, you know, Dick and Jane goes up the hill for 2 hours straight.
Yeah.
As long as the visual is captivating, I'm in. And yeah. It was very much a success here.
I'd agree. And what do you think of the soundtrack? Because this is quite a mixed soundtrack. There's a lot of diegetic sound, and you know, there's the soundtrack as well. I personally loved it. I loved every note. You know, all the rock and roll tunes that were being played, the little Mexican salsas going on, all of that kind of stuff, radio music, along with the score. I felt like it was so complete. I watched another film tonight. I watched Sneakers, and the two soundtracks were just so jarring. One was perfect, one was so not. For me, I thought the soundtrack was just spot on.
It was. I mean, I didn't even really notice it so much, the soundtrack. I mean, I noticed it, you know, when like the rock and roll play was playing, but otherwise, again, I was just lost in the visuals.
Mm. I think that's probably a good thing. You know, the rock and roll was there because it was loud and it was supposed to be loud. You're supposed to feel like Janet Leigh was feeling. And
rock and roll.
Yeah, go on.
I say the rock and roll was a character all in itself, though, the way they were using it.
Yeah, and you know what? In the 1950s, rock and roll could have been seen as a troublesome teen in itself.
It was absolutely.
Troublesome thing. And when you hear it, it's loud and it's annoying and it's in the way of peace.
Right.
And then the only way to stop it is to smash someone's head through a jukebox. Which was the scene where we see Vargas completely exploding. I was like, I'm not a cop anymore, I'm a husband. Where's my wife? It was rather, you know, that was the only bit where it's like, okay, he's woken up, he's got a wife who he cares about.
Right.
And
I think it was more along the lines of, donde es mi esposa?
Yeah, I think it was, donde es mi esposa? What have you done with her?
But that was one of the stoutest jukeboxes you'll ever see, because he slammed that guy up against it like 3 times, and that music didn't miss a beat.
I know. Right. I know.
Those things all ran on vinyl inside there. That thing should have... I mean, breathing on it would make it skip.
Yeah.
Well, I think I should drag you all back to an ending here and make you all give this film a rating out of 5.
Okay.
Allison, go for it.
5. I know it's got problems, but it's still perfect. And it's a shame that Orson neither cared about it nor wanted anything to do with it at the end, nor really wanted to make it in the first place. But it seems such a fitting end to his direction and his success in Hollywood. And unfortunately, it wasn't a success in Hollywood. It blows my mind. It should have been. But maybe it was too photographically perfect for Hollywood to handle, which is why they changed and mashed it and altered the story after he'd finished filming. But it was put back together again as he wished. He even got to like the title he'd been lumbered with, and he even got to kind of like his film, and I'm glad he did. I certainly thought that, you know, despite the dodgy Mexican accents or lack thereof, and stupid people, it's a true masterpiece and one that teaches a great deal about cinema.
Awesome. Rick?
I'm going to have to give it a 3. I understand what you're saying, Allison, about it being visually stunning, and I don't disagree. I think some of the work actually did hit me as like, whoa, that's really cool. But I don't know that much about filmmaking, you know, from a more, you know, as intimate a level as you all do. And this film just really didn't say anything to me. I watched it because you know, we were doing a show about it. I think I might have, you know, the title was not unfamiliar to me, but it certainly wasn't something, you know, like a Network or a Clockwork Orange or Citizen Kane or something like that, where it was one of those movies that I know I should have watched by now, but just hadn't gotten around to. And when I finished watching it, I was like, why did you guys want to watch this? And then I did some research, and all of these great filmmakers and great actors are talking about what a classic it is. Mm. And until you just explained why, I still didn't get it. And if it takes that much education to be able to appreciate a film, to me, it's not that successful. And so I'm gonna give it a solid 3.
Okay. Scott?
I think this is going to be one of the very few times that you'll ever hear me say this, but this is a film I would like to see remade now. If they clean up the story, shore up the script, and make the characters a bit more believable, a little less ignorant of their circumstances, but keep the focus on the visuals and the filming techniques, like they did with this one. Make it look just as impressive today as this movie did when it was made, but also fix all the plot problems. I think I would enjoy seeing it and see how it would come about these days, because I have to agree that visually it is an incredibly well-made film, but the story and the performances hung me up too much to give it more than a 3.
Okay. Finally, Matt, then.
I'm going to give it a 4. The visuals, like I said, that's what really pulled it ahead for me. I couldn't quite get past the characters and some of the obvious, I don't want to say plot holes, but just the obvious, like, things that were dangling right in characters' faces that they were just missing to bump it up to a 5, like Allison. But I have no problem giving it a solid 4. And my question for Scott is, would you want him to remake it in present day or set back in the 1950s?
That's actually a good question. I had been picturing in my head what these days you can almost call anything an inevitable remake, because they're eventually going to get around to remaking everything. So when it happens, I was envisioning having it set in the present day, but it could just as well work as a period piece.
And another question, who would you have direct it? Because that's what we're swapping out here. If we're swapping out things, we're mainly swapping out the director here. So who would you have direct it to achieve what Orson Welles did in 1958?
I do not know. See, unfortunately, I'm not as up on my directors as some people. You know what? Yeah, why not? If we're going for stuff that is visually impressive, give it to Nolan. Let Christopher Nolan do it.
Yeah.
How about Guillermo del Toro?
Ooh.
He'd be good.
That would be another good
Interesting.
One.
Although I don't really want to take part in this, because this is kind of like suggesting that Sunflower should be repainted or that somebody should cover the White Album. It should not be done. You should just, it's a masterpiece. Just step back away and just let it be. Let it be.
Yeah, I don't think it needs to be remade. I think that it stands quite well as the film it is. I don't see that. I didn't really have a problem with plot holes or anything. I didn't find anything, you know, despite what I said earlier about I've been thinking about what I said about the fact that the crime wasn't that important, and that being a failing, and maybe that was a little harsh. You know, it may have just been that, you know, this was the equivalent of a M. Night Shyamalan twist of, you're trying to figure this out, and that's really not what you should be focusing on. What you should be focusing on what's going on between fat guy here and this dude over here.
It's just the scenario in which the story itself unfolds.
Yeah.
It's just the setting.
Yeah. It didn't grab me. I'm not saying it's a bad film. It's not a great film for me. And I don't think it needs to be remade. I think it's perfect as it is, just not perfect for me.
Mm. Right.
Well, it's a movie you should see, so I recommend everybody go and watch it. And I will watch it again because we bought it.
Final score 15, then?
Final score of 15. Better than Sneakers. There you go.
Definitely better than Sneakers.
Allison didn't like Sneakers.
Oh, no.
No, I'm sad.
I didn't say I didn't like Sneakers. I gave it a 3 and said it was all right.
Yeah, that's true.
Now
I would have given Sneakers a 6.
That does have
Same here.
It does have stupid stuff in it that goes way beyond any stupidity that you've just seen in Touch of Evil.
I can't remember if I've ever seen Sneakers or not.
Oh, you'd like Sneakers. Go and watch Sneakers.
Yeah.
I think I did see it, but I'm not sure. I'll have to look it up.
Well, it's a movie you should see. It's a solid 3. Yeah.
Well, thank you for joining us, everybody. It's been an absolute delight to have you all talk about Touch of Evil.
Thank you.
It was nice to talk about a highbrow film. I don't feel like I've done that for a while.
I don't know what your problem with Desperado is and why that's not a highbrow film. That's a highbrow film.
Did I have a problem with Desperado or did I give it 4 out of 5?
I don't remember.
I believe I gave it 4 out of 5.
You did, you gave it a 4 out of 5.
So, you know.
What else have we got to do this week? There are two more of these to do.
Next week, Pacific Rim.
Oh, you see, I still haven't seen it. I want to see it. I'm excited to see it.
It's a lot of fun for what it is.
Exactly. Now, if an episode has been done on Desperado, then are we going to do the prequel and the sequel eventually?
Ooh.
Maybe so.
Maybe the prequel. I'm not sure about the sequel. But I've still got the two of them unwatched here, so we'll see. We'll see.
And to answer your question, Richard, for the rest of this week in our recording schedule, we have Heathers next, followed by Misery.
Highbrow films, Alison.
No, they're not. No, they're not. They're kind of... Well, Heathers is a bit landmarky. Misery's a good example of a Stephen King film. Yeah, we're all right. They're not highbrow, though. Don't kid yourself. They're not up in the 150 greatest films of all time. But they're all right. They're all right.
They're no Judge Dredd.
No Judge Dredd. No. And what was that thing that you were talking about earlier, Rick? The worst Pacific film ever Rim? Made?
Oh, Manos. Manos, the Hands of Fate.
Yeah, let me write that down so I never see it.
It's not hard to avoid.
I'm going to go ahead and throw out the suggestion right now. One of these, like the next time that we do a group week-long recording session for movies you should see, it should be movies you shouldn't see. Ooh. Manos, the Hands of Fate, Birdemic.
Birdemic.
The Room.
Birdemic.
I want to see Birdemic.
You have to watch it. I would do a 3-hour episode of movies you shouldn't see with just you and me talking about Birdemic.
And you know some of the shit he's got in his collection.
I just need to be out that day. I don't care what I'm doing, but I'm doing something that day.
You'll be fine with it, don't worry.
I'm doing something.
Just get a full bottle and then another half bottle of wine in you before you watch Birdemic. Alison, you will like it just as much as everyone else.
Scott, you might not have remembered, but I'm old now, and time is precious. I'm not going to sit down and waste however many minutes of my life remaining watching shit. I've got to be judicious at this age. I've got to be. Time's ticking.
Okay, we'll put it out to the listeners. Listeners, any of you that have seen or have heard of Birdemic... Now is the time. Send in your emails, get onto the forums, whatever you got to do. Put the word out to convince Alison to watch Birdemic, and we'll do an episode about it.
Scott, another thing that you've misunderstood is how much people love me and care for me and want me to be okay.
If they and love they will, you, they'll make you watch
they
the
They will
movie.
Protect me from it. They will build a fortress in between me and it. Trust me. I've heard from these people. They mean business.
We're going to do a bonus episode of just me trying to convince her to watch this movie. We'll just keep on going. Just let it run, Richard. Just let the recording go. We'll let you know when we're finished. It'll be about another 45 minutes.
I say the next 24-hour episode is Scott convincing Alison to watch Birdemic.
See, I haven't even got time to have the argument, you know. It's just like, that's precious, dude. I could be stroking a puppy instead.
The time we're wasting arguing about whether you should or should not watch it is time you could just be spending watching it and get it over with.
Could be stuck in a puppy.
Is that a metaphor or something? Because if I were to say, I'll be back in 10 minutes, metaphor. I'm just going to go stroke a puppy.
It's not a metaphor.
Oh, jeez.
I mean a puppy. Like that one over there.
He's 6 and a half.
He's still a damn puppy.
His puppy days are behind
Look
him.
Look at him, though. He doesn't want me to watch it. He wants me to stroke
he
him
He watches
instead.
All kinds of rubbish, though. He loves it. He likes Animal Planet.
He you make him watch?
He likes Animal Planet.
Honestly, every time we leave the house, the TV goes on for Barkley, and we don't just put any old channel on. It's got to be Animal Planet. It's got to be, because there's got to be like other animals for him to feel happy.
Isn't 2/3 of that of that programming things eating other things?
No, it's Caesar. He watches Caesar.
He watches Caesar.
And he actually goes and sits and watches it. I mean, he's aware that the television exists and he will look at it. But he doesn't. It doesn't take him over in any way. But when Caesar is on, he will go and watch the television. When there are dogs on television, he goes. He watches them. So I always think he likes that. Surely.
So he's got to have the telly on when we leave the house.
When he was little, he used to go and try and sniff the TV. I can see a dog. Why can't I smell it? And he'd go and try and sniff the TV. And now he's given up on that. Maybe he's just figured out it's just a picture of a dog.
I think he has, yeah.
I don't know.
I have to try that with my dog, see what happens.
I don't know what he's like. He doesn't like other dogs, though. That's the thing.
He does. He's just like, I can't be bothered with you. You're not a human.
I suppose. You've got nothing for me. Yeah. That's his attitude. Right, let's end the show.
Yeah.
We're still on a show, do you remember?
Yeah.
Thank you for listening, everybody. You can hear us on other shows and stuff. And White Star 5, and I Do Lots, and so does Alison. Go and check them all out at simplysyndicated.com, unless you've got this episode from there. You know what we do. Thank you for listening, everybody. We'll be back with another episode one day. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Goodbye.